Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in a still dry Fargo studio with Ashley Thornburg, my co-host. Ashley, how
are
you today?
Don't invite tragedy to come in. We've already had a fire a few months ago. We don't need rain coming in.
We're getting some rain today, that's for sure.
It is.
But it's what we need. Today, It's all about food and the diversity of food, Ashley.
Yes, and diversity of people cooking our food, and particularly delicious and nutritious food, and the importance of knowing where your food comes from and interacting with it.
We have two conversations today with chefs. In the second half, Ho-Chunk Winnebago private chef and restaurant general manager Candace Stock on Indigenous food and building relationships. She's deeply inspired and even calls herself a fangirl of Sean Sherman, Ashley.
And he is our first guest, the Sioux Chef, and that's S-I-O-U-X. He is an Oglala Lakota chef who's been on the forefront of reintroducing Indigenous foods. So think wild game instead of factory-farmed animals, and no gluten or artificial sweeteners. The Julia Child Award winner owns Awamni in Minneapolis and runs Natifs, the North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems website that helps people source Indigenous ingredients. He's also a James Beard Award winner, and he recently appeared on an episode of Top Chef as a guest chef and judge on an episode highlighting Indigenous cuisine. Chef Sean Sherman, Pila Maye, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on yet another accolade for you. Let's talk about what it was like being on Top Chef, because there's cooking for friends, there's cooking in a restaurant, and then there's competitive cooking and judging that's being filmed on TV. So talk about the atmosphere of what it was like to be in that situation.
You know, it was really interesting. It was in Milwaukee. It was at a warehouse just kind of on the outskirts of town. It was, you know, pretty well out of the way and invite only, of course. And they're obviously very secretive about the whole show, so we weren't really able to talk about it much until the show comes out. And it was just an interesting thing. So I had actually never watched an episode of Top Chef because I just don't watch a lot of TV. And they were kind of surprised by that. But I was like, well, it is what it is. And they're like, do you want to see some episodes? I'm like, no, I'm on it now. So I guess I get the gist. but it was interesting. Just trying to follow the cues, and being a guest chef was great. And just having that opportunity to hit that mainstream crowd with a lot of the work that we do and this challenge that we gave to the chefs that were still in the mix of the show. And, you know, just really talking about paying homage to the land and the cultures and these really special ingredients. And we brought a ton of ingredients with us for them to choose from. So we created a huge situation of plants and wild foods and games and things like that that they would be able to choose from. So it was fun to put it together.
Yeah. And how would you characterize the reaction of the competitors? Was anybody saying, what, there's no gluten? What am I supposed to do?
Yeah, I think they did a pretty good job of showcasing some of the feelings of some of the chefs when they were presented this particular challenge, you know, and not using any dairy, flour, sugar, or even citrus, you know, and just getting them to try to think about what are they going to do, you know. So it's definitely challenging, because it's definitely thinking way outside the box of what's normal for us, you know, because so much of our food systems are Eurocentric. And it's really important to think about, like, you know, we're on this beautiful land space, and, you know, the Eurocentric diet has kind of pretty much ignored the amazing bounty of flavors and cultures that still exist here across North America. So I think it was a really fun challenge to present to this team and to do it on this really gigantic national and international platform, too.
Yeah, it is a big platform, and it's a different platform too, unlike things like the James Beard Award, where people who are really engaged with food are going to be paying attention. You might get someone who's just a little bit more casual of a cook, or even someone who's just watching TV for the sake of watching TV. And you have such a very different approach to food, specifically in contrast to what you mentioned earlier, this very Eurocentric diet that can be real heavy in things like gluten and dairy. things that you worked really hard to take out of your diet. What did you notice about your health or your sleep patterns or what have you when you first really started to re-indigenize your diet?
I just think it, like, the North American indigenous diet is just so healthy, you know, because obviously if anybody's had food at the restaurant Awamini in Minneapolis that we opened up 3 years ago, that is just completely different because there's no gluten, no dairy, no processed cane sugar, no beef, pork, chicken, you know, no ranch dressing, no sodas, you know, so there's all these things that don't exist, but we have so much more because there's so much wild plants that are on the menu, so many different kinds of proteins, whether it's like elk or venison or bison or rabbit or crickets or lake fish or birds or whatever it might be. Like, there's a lot to choose from, you know, and I feel like, you know, you do really feel really, really good when you leave, and because you can eat a lot there and you can feel full, but when you leave, like, it doesn't weigh you down, it doesn't make like you feel like your body hates you like you just ate an 8,000 calorie hamburger, you know. And so, like, it's a really important way to look at it, and I think as restaurateurs we should be a lot more responsible with the health of our guests and really thinking about what we're feeding them and obviously where our food comes from, because a big part of our work is trying to support indigenous producers, which we prioritize. So we try to purchase as much as we can from indigenous producers first, because it wouldn't mean the same thing if we were saying we're doing Native American food but then buying everything from Sysco or something, you know.
Yeah, sourcing ingredients like this can get very difficult. Tell us, Sean, about this other effort that you have started, NATIFS, the North American Traditional Indigenous Food Systems.
Yeah, we're working really hard with Natives. We have a space in Midtown Global Market in South Minneapolis called Indigenous Food Lab, where we have a Native market space that's open to the public. People can go there. You can get a light lunch there too, and it's not too expensive. But we have a whole bunch of products that people can purchase to take home to cook with, from Native producers. So we have close to 50 different Native producers on our shelves right now, and that list keeps growing. And people can also order that online, so it can be shipped to you. So if you want some different kinds of wild rice or different kinds of corns or beans or just some fun products, you know, there's some beef jerkies or some baby foods, there's all sorts of stuff coming from Native producers that we're just featuring, but we're also working on making that into some kind of distribution, because we want to get that those products directly into tribal communities. So we're setting up systems to get these foods directly into tribal communities, because here in Minnesota obviously we have 11 federally recognized tribes, and we're trying to get this food directly out there, and we're also tagging a lot of education. So we're recording a lot of videos for people. What do you do if you have a couple pounds of dried corn? How do you cook with it? You know, how can you use it at home? And so we're making lots of easy to follow video recipes for people to do that. And we just have a big production kitchen that makes a lot of products. And even the restaurant's a part of our nonprofit, because the restaurant creates jobs. The restaurant moves a lot of food product. So we're just pushing a lot of money directly towards those producers. And it just becomes a really loud voice for people to come and learn and experience. And we're getting ready to replicate this whole model. So we're moving into Montana this year and setting up a whole nother regional center point for support, for development, and for just trying to get more and more food distribution out there and making this food accessible. Yeah. And beyond that, we're moving all over North America.
Yeah. So what does being on a show like Top Chef mean for the movement that you have been so passionate about and been spearheading for so long?
It just helps us with a bigger platform, so we're able to really showcase, have a louder voice to reach a whole bunch of audience that might not know much about our work and might get curious and start to research and find out more information and maybe even support, you know, because we are a nonprofit, so we're always looking for people to help us move into this next generation as we're trying to just get more foods out there, because we're really trying to build a system for the future, and we're trying to build something that doesn't exist, you know. And I just want to change the way things were when I grew up on Pine Ridge Reservation, where we didn't have access to healthy foods. We had one grocery store that serviced an area the size of Connecticut. And, you know, I was growing up with primarily government commodity foods that were very unhealthy. And there's a lot of health epidemic on communities like where I grew up because of that food system.
We're visiting today with Sean Sherman, an Oglala Lakota chef who was recently on an episode of Top Chef, working as a judge and guest chef and really educating people about indigenous food systems. And Sean, you just said next generation. We want to let our listeners know that coming up in the second half of today's show, we're going to be visiting with indigenous chef Candace Stock about what it means to be growing up in the shadow of people who have come before her and getting to have this legacy to build on. Sean, I want to ask you about being on the show and that educational piece, because of course people watching the show, they're kind of there for escapism and entertainment value, but more than just talking about the ingredients and how they may or may not be different and the health impacts of our food choices. Did you get to talk about that other educational piece of building these systems and trying to make this a little bit more of a nationwide effort when you were on Top Chef?
Yeah, and we did our best to explain. We had a moment where we got to sit down with the chefs and we presented them. So with my friend Elena Terry, who's Ho-Chunk from Wisconsin, and we got to sit down with all the different chefs on Top Chef that were still there and have a dinner and be able to talk over a lot of questions about things. And we did get to explain a lot, you know, but of course the show is heavily edited. So in the end product, you get so much of the storytelling, and that's really up to their editors. But we did our best to make sure that we were talking about real things, because we do want to use this as an opportunity to help educate and help bring some curiosity of things. And food is a safe place, you know, because food can open up a lot of curiosity about other cultures and understanding. And there's a lot to learn, because if you grew up in America, you really don't know much about indigenous history, if even American history. And I think it's really important for us to learn those things, you know.
Cooking for TV, did you find that you had to be sort of performative, or did you get to be just you?
I felt like I was able to be just me for the time being. And it was definitely a transition, because, you know, I haven't done those kinds of shows before. I don't know if I would change anything. I think I might just have a little bit more confidence of speaking up, because there weren't really any cues to, they weren't like, what do you think, Sean, or something. You know, I just had to figure out how to put myself into the conversation, which I figured out over time throughout the recording of the show. But it was just, you know, it was 2 days of recording, and, you know, I felt like it was a great opportunity. So I'm just really happy that they included us and included this really unique challenge that you don't often see on national TV.
Yeah. So often I hear in conversations about indigenous food, this stressing of the relationship. And you said it earlier when you said paying homage to the land and paying homage even to the food. What does a word like relationship mean to you? And then specifically, what is your relationship to food and to land?
Well, I think if you're looking at how indigenous cultures had survived for countless generations, there was a deep relationship with the world around us, with the plants, with the animals, with just the way the world worked, with the seasons, with everything, you know. And I think that we've lost that because, you know, because of colonial values, we've really fallen really away from learning about the world that we live in, particularly, you know. We don't learn about any of the plants around us or the trees around us. I always tease in a lot of the talks that I do that kids can name more Kardashians than they can tree species, you know, because that's our education system. And we need to like really focus on learning as much as we can from this really valuable knowledge base of indigenous peoples, not just here in America, but on a global scale, whose cultures have also been dismantled by colonial histories. And we just really need to think about how can we learn to be better humans by connecting with the world around us better, because we live on this planet and we should be taking care of this planet. And there's so much life that the world can give to us, you know, because the, you know, plants are everything. It's food, it's medicine, it's crafting, it's clothing, it's lodging, it's tools, it's weapons, it's art, it's all sorts of things, you know. So we should be really looking at how can we live with this nature instead of trying to live above it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Sean, if you could take us back to your time as a surveyor for the Forest Service and the amount of time that you got to spend in nature and how that ended up influencing as well your approach to food.
Well, that was a really important job for me because I'd already been working in restaurants for a little while. And then I was living in the Northern Black Hills. That's where I finished high school. And I was in a little town called Spearfish. And I got a job with the Forest Service right out of high school. And my job was a field surveyor. So I had to learn the names of all the plants and trees because I had to go out there in the forest and write them down and do these little surveys, you know. And I'd spent a lot of time growing up outside anyways because, you know, as Gen X, we were all latchkey. And, our parents' version of parenting was just stay outside until dark. So we spent a lot of time outside, you know. And so I think it's really important to, you know, be connected like that and to have that moment of education to start to learn about all these plants and animals around us. You know, I think it's really valuable. And I think that we should do that more. And we're trying to do that with a lot of the education we're creating at Natives.
Yeah. And I imagine you can name more trees than Kardashians.
I can. I don't think if I could name a Kardashian.
Well, it is May in the Northern Great Plains, and so much of that paying attention to nature is this eating seasonally. There is a time and a place to be eating fiddlehead ferns and morels, and it's not necessarily the time when you're going to be eating some of the heavier, more comfort kind of winter foods. So, Sean, what are you eating right now?
Oh, you know, I've been just excited to be outside because everything is popping up, you know. So we've collected ramps, we've collected wild ginger. Obviously, the morels are out. I keep finding random ones here and there. And yeah, I love this time of year because everything's just, you know, starting to blossom and it fills out so fast. All of a sudden, it's just so green, you know. And I just think it's a really exciting time. So we were just playing, but I love food, you know. So I just love eating whatever's fresh. I have a ton of edible things in my own backyard that I'll just grab as needed. And I think it's important to have that knowledge and to be able to just make that a part of your daily life as much as you can.
Sean, I've been to your restaurant once in the cities and am very much looking forward to my next trip to the cities to make a visit to Ouamni. And in addition to the food being utterly delicious and incredibly satisfying to eat, I couldn't help but notice that everyone who worked there seemed genuinely happy to be working there. And I don't feel like you get that very often when you go out to eat. Was that something that came organically, or did you really go out of your way to hire specific people to represent the movement that you are doing?
I would say that, you know, I love our team over at Ouamani. I think that we put a lot of effort into the training and the development so they can articulate, because the front of the house, especially, they have to be able to talk and educate a lot of people about this different set of food that's unfortunately not normal out there, you know. And so I think that they're very proud of it because a lot of our staff identifies as indigenous, you know, and we have 100 employees throughout the year there. And that number grows to up to 150 in the summertime when we're really busy. And, you know, probably up to 70% of our staff identifies as indigenous. So this work means a lot to them, you know, and they're very happy to talk about it, you know. And we've hired a lot of people from Native communities and Native families that are really excited to do something that really represents their own culture. And I think that's a big part of it too. It's just that, you know, it just gives us this opportunity to be really proud of these foods, to be really proud of the creativity that the team is putting there and the creations that the chefs and his team makes. And, you know, so I think that it's a really unique restaurant for that particular situation.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier when you were talking about chefs needing to be mindful of the health consequences of our diets and the health opportunities of our diets. Can you expand a little bit more on that? The responsibility that you feel beyond just being good to the ingredients, being good to the people who come in and eat at Ouamni or who visit the Indigenous Food Lab at Midtown.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I feel like restaurants, you know, they're privileged, you know, so that's they're not everybody can afford to go out to eat all the time, number one. And, you know, I know that restaurants don't really help with food security or food access or things like that, because there's a large expense that goes along with that, you know. And, you know, so people that do go out, they like to see some creativity. They like to eat delicious food, of course, you know, and there's just so much mediocrity out there. There's so often, because I travel so much and I'm in restaurants a lot, and I feel like I could write the menu all the time when I walk into a lot of restaurants, because it's always just keyword cafes, you know. It's just, you have like buffalo cauliflower and some kind of burger with all these things on it, and you know, there's always a ubiquitous Caesar salad on the menu, and just things that, like, there's just lack of creativity, but people are just doing greatest hits because they want people to buy as much food as they can, right? And I get it, they're business choices, but I feel like I just wish people would be more conscious of, like, who are you purchasing from? Like, are you just buying everything from a big box truck? Can you support local producers? You know, can you support local producers that don't have a lot of privilege too? So we try to focus on a lot of BIPOC producers, because obviously Indigenous producers first, but we just want, there's some producers that just have a lot more money that can afford, you know, the organic labels and have bigger distributions and take up all the space, you know. And, you know, so we just really want to help out, but we should be keeping our food dollars within our own community and not just sending everything off to giant corporations, you know, because if you're just buying all your food from a Walmart, then who are you really supporting? And so I think it's really important to be really considerate and really intentional along the way. And as a restaurateur, we tried to really create some strong values and some strong intentions as we move forward, just to open up some conversations about that, but just know that we're doing something good.
Do you ever think about what you're doing in terms of legacy? I mean, that almost feels like such a shallow word when you think about all of the elements that you are trying to do and how they feel so much more. They're not about you. They're about the food. They're about everyone who comes after you. They're about the earth. But do you ever think about what you're doing in terms of legacy?
So I feel like I've found this path. I think this path found me, possibly, but I see this vision of being able to be impactful and to hopefully make some changes and to really set up the next generation for success. And you're right that this has nothing to do with me, because I could just go the route of celebrity chef and take a bunch of endorsements and make a ton of money and make it about me, but it's not. I have this unique opportunity to change the way things were where I grew up, because growing up on a reservation, you're still living in a colonized, segregated state. You know, it's very racist, you know, just because of how it's set up and how it's removed from other communities. And there's a lot of issues there. There's a lot of lack of food access still going on out there. And I just want to change the way people think about that. So I feel like I only have X amount of good working years in my life to even do something impactful and make a change. So I don't know if you want to call it legacy work or what it is, but for me, it's just the path that I'm on. And I feel like we've come so far and we've created a lot and we've got many awards and many accolades, but again, it's not about me. And I feel like I'm just taking my first steps. I feel like we're just starting, because there's so much to change. And it's just, you know, it's unfortunate that a restaurant like Awamni is so rare. Like, most cities have no choices for Native American foods, you know? And I want the next generation, when they go out, to be like, I don't know what I want tonight. Do I want pizza? Do I want Chinese? Do I want Native American? And I just want us to be on the list, you know?
Yeah. You do get to travel, and of course, eating Indigenous, you know, among the Maori people in what is now New Zealand would be very different from eating among the Oglala Lakota, and be very different among eating among the Quechua people. Are you hopeful about this as a global reckoning?
Absolutely, you know, because our work is really focused on kind of deconstructing colonization, and which is why we use the term decolonize, because we look at the values that colonization has brought, which was a rampant destruction of environment, pulling out natural resources, making some people very rich, you know, and some people very poor, a lot of dehumanization and violence against people of color, particularly, and especially the peoples of the places that colonization is coming into effect, right? Because colonization is just the policy or practice practice of acquiring full or partial political control over another country, occupying with settlers, and then exploiting it economically. And so we see that happening not just here in North America with Native Americans, but it's a global situation because it's happened across the globe. North America, Central America, South America, Africa, India, Southeast Asia, Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, and it goes on, you know, and there's so many indigenous cultures. And to truly understand indigeneity, indigenous cultures around the world, it's really understanding diversity, you know. So it's learning how to embrace those diversities, learning how to listen to indigenous peoples who have really been connected with the land spaces that they're from and that they live on, and the traditions and the connection with the plants and how the plants can really help us moving forward. Because we're going through a lot of crisis coming up with climate change, with water crisis, and we have to figure out ways to adapt and learn and work with the earth. And there's no better way than to listen to indigenous peoples who have learned how to be adaptable, who have learned how to really connect with the plants and the soils and the seasons. And we have a lot of work to do, you know, to dismantle something that's too normal in our lifestyle of just allowing so much destruction and violence across the world happen on a daily basis.
Chef Sean Sherman, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Oglala Lakota Sioux Chef Sean Sherman on his recent appearance on Top Chef as a guest judge on Indigenous cuisine. In the second half of today's show, a young woman inspired by Sean's decades of work promoting Native food and culture. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing the 50th anniversary of A Prairie Home Companion to the Bluestem Amphitheater in Moorhead, Minnesota, on September 26th. More information at jadepresents.com.
And we're back on Main Street. I'm Ashley Thornburg. In the first half of today's show, we heard Sean Sherman and his decades of work promoting and growing indigenous food systems. He's inspired a generation of chefs, including our next guest, Candace Stock, general manager and catering lead at Birnbaum's in Fargo. She's also a private chef focusing on indigenous foods. Candace Pinagigi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So when you hear something like Sean Sherman is on Top Chef, what does that mean to you?
I have been a fangirl of Sean Sherman since I was in college. My grandpa would send me articles every time he found them, and he was just like, Candace, this could be you. I went to culinary school in New York, and my focus was always on culinary arts, and so having that type of representation in my industry was really huge for me.
Yeah. Did you go to culinary school specifically, do you think, to be representing, you know, indigenous foodways, or did you just want to work with food no matter what?
I always wanted to work with food, but I honestly didn't know that it was even an option to represent my culture that way, because there was no indigenous chefs that I knew of growing up that were making indigenous food. I mean, I knew chefs in the industry, but they weren't making our food.
Our food. What are some of your favorite foods from growing up?
I eat so much wild rice. and then my family being Ho-Chunk Winnebago, we have very beautiful Indian corn down in Nebraska, and that's something that is very much a treat. It's harder to come by, it's harder to process, but that's something that we always incorporate into our family's celebrations or holidays.
Yeah, and your dad grew up farming and also hunting. Foraging you came to a little bit later in life. What are some of your favorite moments in the whole meal preparation time for you?
I'd say it started outside, getting ingredients from the garden, or there's actually a chapter in Sean Sherman's cookbook that talks about his father or grandfather, and they used to just drive down the road and shoot pheasant right from their truck. And my dad did that when we were, yeah. And so if we got one, we'd run out and grab it. And that was dinner for the night. But, minding all the buckshot. But, it's just like sourcing it ourselves and bringing it in and really taking in the nutrients and being able to taste the earth, I think.
Yeah. You know, talking about you being heavily influenced by Sean Sherman, you are a Ho-Chunk Winnebago woman, among other ancestries. He is an Oglala Lakota man. It's one thing for you to be influenced by his tradition and be able to celebrate that because you've both kind of grown up in the legacy of a colonizing effort to take away all food and ceremony and religious traditions and, frankly, sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Are we in danger ever, do you think, of this swinging a little bit too far? And where I'm going with that is I see a lot of things where, you know, I, as just some white girl, could go book a private experience to go take ayahuasca or to go take peyote or things that are actually ceremonial and deeply medicinal and something that is only in the hands of a trained medicine man or medicine woman. I'm struggling with forming this question here.
Yeah.
Because this indigenous representation has been a really wonderful thing, mm-hmm, for so many people. Is it possible that we are going to go too far in this direction of just a different kind of exploitative?
What I was raised with was that our connection to our lands, our ancestry, is our medicine.
Yeah.
So it's believed that we were all brought into this world by different creators. And for Native peoples, this land was designed for us. The creator put certain things here to be our medicine. There are also things that can affect us negatively. The importance for me of incorporating my ancestors' diet into my own is that it does make me feel whole. And for other people to be introduced to it, I think, is important. But knowing their ancestry, they have to be careful because their bodies are not going to react to it the same way.
Hmm.
For a lot of Indigenous people, we suffer from diabetes and alcoholism, and it's because those are things that were not a part of our diets before.
Tens of thousands of years.
Yeah, and so by taking part in those things and incorporating them into our diets, it's caused disease. And so the only way to get back is to follow these ways of our ancestors. And so that's the warning I give to anyone that is participating or that wants to have these experiences. It is important to know what it can do to your body. Everything is meant to be taken in moderation, and when it comes to the foods that you consume, it has to be a respectful, reciprocal relationship. Overindulging and taking more than what you need is always going to be bad for you.
Yeah. We're visiting today with Candace Stock. She is a general manager at Burn Bombs Restaurant, where she is also the catering lead, and she also does many private chef events, often specializing in Indigenous meals and even leads foraging tours. Candace, I want to hear about an effort that you are doing, which is making meal kits for White Earth. Tell us a little bit about how that process works.
Yeah, I got approached by one of the organizers, and a lot of the meal kits that were being provided to the White Earth Reservation were not indigenous, but they were very cultural based. So they had some Thai meal kits, and they did like bison burgers or like indigenous influenced meals. But the meals that I've been doing for them are strictly using indigenous ingredients, and they're incredibly accessible to anyone through the Mana Food Co-op. And the goal, I think, is just to be able to bring nourishment to the reservation and especially our elders.
Is it kind of like those, you know, HelloFresh or whatever those food boxes are, where they just get delivered and you get to just prep the meal for yourself? Or is there a different kind of educational component here?
No, that's pretty much how it works. They'll portion all the ingredients at the co-op and ship it out. And once you purchase it, you go on the website for the co-op, and I just demo how everything is prepared.
Oh, that's wonderful. You are also busy doing things like preparing meals for government people. You're working with the Canadian consulate. What is this?
They have a lot of truth and reparations events come September, October for Indigenous peoples, and they're trying to bring more of that to the United States. And so the goal is to get as many Indigenous leaders together to collaborate and plan events for their community, or really just networking. And it's brought about a lot of really, really great connections.
Do you see a big difference between Canada and government relations with the First Nations people, and the difference between how the U.S. government or the U.S. at large, when it comes to dealing with the legacy of racism? Is there a substantial difference between the Canadian government and the U.S. government?
There is. Just the amount of education that they provide. I moved from here to Northern Virginia. My mom took a job on the East Coast. And when I got there, I introduced myself, and everyone wanted to know, so what are you? And I was like, I'm Native American. And they're like, no, they went extinct. Ooh. And I was like, what? Yeah. And so, I mean, they're right there next to the Potomac and Rappahannock, and I mean that's Cherokee people land, but you don't see natives there. I mean, my mom worked for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and so you'd see natives working there, but otherwise, yeah. In the public school system in Virginia, they thought that I was pretty rare.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you have a memory you'd be willing to share of that?
Well, really, just being out there, one girl ran up and thought I was like darker when I was younger, and my hair was pretty curly, but she thought I had a weave-in because she couldn't tell if I was mixed or white or Mexican, and I had a hard time finding friends when I first moved out there. But once they found out that I was Native American, it's kind of what happens in any group setting where there aren't a lot of Native Americans. You get kind of coined the Pocahontas or Sacagawea. And so until I moved back to Fargo, it's kind of been hard to have a community of other Native peoples. Wow.
Until you moved back here, you think it is stronger here?
I do, yeah.
Okay. How do you classify the relationships here? Are they a little better?
Yeah, no, and I think that there are a lot of really strong Native people that are making a name for themselves in their fields, especially with the local universities.
You are active in that yourself. You're doing some work with Concordia College as part of their Indian education program. Just briefly, kind of what is that and what is your role within that program?
Yeah, so just this year they started recruiting more Indigenous professionals to host classes, whether it be food preparation, foraging, storytelling, history. And so I've been able to participate in a little bit more of that. And then we have a lot more plans to do more. And it's really great because it's not just college level. Like, they bring in all ages to learn about Indigenous culture and foodways.
Yeah. Are we at a point where this whole kind of like learning thing and the question asking, you know, is it getting better? And what I mean by that is I'm thinking about these kids who were just saying, oh, you're Pocahontas, you know, or whatever, and didn't even know, you know, that your people group wouldn't be from Virginia to begin with, and certainly is not extinct. But then even, you know, I'm thinking of me being on the radio and having this sort of role in media and in asking questions and trying to be somewhat informed here, but are we even asking better questions, or is there still, or do you still deal with a lot of, hey, are you still all living on teepees?
Yeah, I've heard that one.
Yikes.
Well, I think the more questions, the better. I think a lot of people are afraid to ask certain things, and I've never gotten offended when people have asked me about my culture or the ingredients that I'm preparing. I see it as a gift to be able to share.
Yeah.
And so as long as people are willing to receive those gifts, I will be willing to give them.
What do you mean by that, willing to receive the gifts?
I think when asked about culture, I know in the past, like, others had taken offense, like it'll be stolen. And that was something that I was always warned when I was younger, is you know, we don't tell white folk about these things in our families, our culture, because then they will try to use it, or they will take it from us.
Sure.
But there are a lot more people that are respectful about our culture now and understanding it and appreciating it, because it's been so swept under the rug, you know, like no one knows about our food ways, and they finally want to. So.
Yeah. What are your favorite ingredients to be working with?
My grandma always talked about milkweed soup and how it's such an acquired taste.
And what does that mean? Is it bitter?
It is bitter. Okay. Yeah. And in the past when I'd had it, it was pretty intense bitter flavors. But I found an old cookbook from White Earth that it's very, very basic, but it was all recipes from the Native American church. And they just briefly talk about the preparations of milkweed and making making soup. And there are ways to balance it. And so it's just kind of rediscovering some of these ingredients like milkweed that have allowed me to prepare it in a new way and really enjoy it, but also give my grandma that experience also. So,
now you have a little boy, right?
I do.
How do you talk to him about food?
He's always out there with me. I bring him out foraging whenever I can, and he's always in the kitchen with me. And so he's going on 5 years old now, but he already understands that we respect our food. He has a pretty advanced palate for a 5 year old.
Yeah, that sounds. He's like he's eating a little bit more than mac and cheese.
Oh, for sure. He loves to eat straight out of the garden. I mean, like, still dirt on the roots, and he's enjoying it. So
yeah, that must feel really gratifying as a mom in particular to get them to eat anything.
Yeah. We went out for lunch not that long ago, and he was like, Mom, I could just really go for a salad. And I was like, get out. And he did. He ate a big salad full of tomatoes, and yeah.
Well, it sounds like he's fangirling over you, Candace.
He's a pretty big fan. I'm a fan of him too.
Candace Pinagigi, thank you so much for your time today.
Pinagigi, Ashley.
That was Candace Stock, General Manager and Catering Lead at Burn Bonds in Fargo. She's also a private chef focusing on Indigenous foods. Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 21st. On this date, in 1927, the Dakota Student, UND's student newspaper, printed an article about a paradise proposed by the university's Dean of Engineering. It said, "What would you say if you were told that within 10 years, a half-barren region in North Dakota might be realizing the best crops in the world? You would probably be interested, but skeptical. You would say that this is impossible because of occasional droughts, which destroy potential record-breaking yields." In a statement by Dean of Engineering Elwin F. Chandler that the Dakota Student deemed astounding, the U.S. Geological Survey said that the Devil's Lake region could be raising wheat and other grain crops unrivaled by any other agricultural region in the world. The newspaper continued, "For the past 3 years, Dean Chandler and his associates have been working on a project to bring water into the Souris, James, and Cheyenne River valleys in sufficient quantities to ensure a bumper crop there every year. Beyond reducing the risk of farming, the project advocates claimed it would provide electrical power and water and a summer playground for North Dakota." The Dakota Student asked, "But where is all the water to come from? None of the rivers of the vicinity is large enough, except the Missouri." Chandler responded, "Well, why not the Missouri?" The Dakota Student opined, "Impossible, utterly absurd, you think. But the professor will convince anyone that taking water from the Missouri is not at all impossible or absurd. That it is, on the contrary, quite feasible." Beyond serving as a professor and dean of engineering, Elwin F. Chandler worked for decades as a hydraulic engineer for the Water Resources Branch of the United States Geological Survey. His vision of a reservoir on the Missouri River took hold. The Great Depression would hit North Dakota hard. In the words of author Paul Van de Velder, desperate farmers viewed it as the opening act for the Second Coming. Garrison Dam was built a generation later to great fanfare, but this dam's flooding of the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation was nothing short of catastrophic. Before the federal government named the reservoir Lake Sakakawea, tribal members had another name for it, the Ogre of Fort Berthold. The Missouri River Valley, which had been their ancestral homeland for hundreds of years, was lost to Chandler's paradise. Today's Dakota Daybook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
A woman who's lived all her life by the U.S.-Mexico border sees it as a line with two sides and also as one region. How migration looks at the border on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you listened with us. Tomorrow on the show, as Memorial Day approaches, we'll air an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show as host John Harris visits with Brad Ani, past commander of Fargo American Legion's Post 2. He'll talk about Memorial Day and some of the issues facing veterans.
And we'll also hear from a travel writer about how to travel a smart way during this long holiday weekend. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.